Hi everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema. I'm your host, Elliot. It's great to have you here, Umberto. How are you?
Very good. Hello from London.
Umberto Pasolini is, of course, an Italian director, here to talk about his upcoming film, Nowhere Special, that will be released in the Netherlands on the 23rd of June.
Come down, his father cried. You'll be much safer by my side. They'd never seen a boy so brave. He gave his dad a little whip. Pitch.
John, we realize you want the best for your son.
He deserves a normal family. All the opportunities I never had as a child.
And what does he know of your situation?
One day, Michael, would you like to live in a different town, different home?
I like home.
We'll, of course, be exploring your film, sort of this tender relationship between the father and the son. I won't say too much now. And the story about how you came across this film is also really interesting. But perhaps you can tell us first your journey into film. For those that don't know, you started out as an investment banker, which is quite a different turn to film itself. So how did you make the switch and what made you?
That is true. It's not a very interesting story, but I was one of those young men who doesn't know what to do with his life. And a career in banking was one of the things that was offered to me. And I started that, and it didn't last very long. After 3 years, I decided it wasn't going to be my long-term life. And I always had a passion for cinema since my early teens. And I had the opportunity to meet an English producer, David Putnam, who was about to go to Thailand, indeed, to make a very interesting film called The Killing Fields about the war in Cambodia during the Vietnam War. The war had spilled over into Cambodia. And I flew over to Bangkok. They gave me a very big tray with lots of drinks to give to the melting British crew. It was very, very hot. And they were just coming off a very cold English winter. So they took some time and adapt. And that's how I started. I was an assistant director for many years. And then I grew into producing, and more recently I've also been dabbling in directing. I'm really not a director, but I've directed 3 pictures.
Yeah, you say this very modestly a lot, that you're not a director or you're not creative, which is something I disagree with, but we'll come back to that. I wondered though, what was it that excited you about film, or when you came across working on a film set, how did you know this was where you wanted to be and what you wanted to do?
Well, my love for cinema, in a funny way, was the result of having very little success with the girls in Milan, where I was growing up. So while all my friends had girlfriends, I spent all my evenings at the Cinémathèque in Milan, watching every film of every period of every film school you can imagine, and really got under my skin. The film experience, the watching different cultures through cinema, and it really was a passion. And when I started working, I didn't think that film could really be a career. But my first experience, as we were saying before, was on a very, very interesting film set. The Killing Fields must have been the most interesting film being made out of the UK, out of England, where I was by then living. That year, 1983, you know, my first experience of cinema was at the highest possible quality, at the highest possible level. And the whole thing was a quality production. And so I was this little T-boy in a very high quality production. And it showed me that making films and not just watching films could be a fascinating, exciting experience. Maybe if I had started on the film I made immediately after that, that was a little comedy in North Rainy London, maybe I wouldn't be still in films today. But because I was allowed to see the more fun aspects and the more stimulating aspects of cinema and rather filmmaking, I stuck to with it. And I had a lot of fun with it for the last 37 years.
What are some of the films that made such an impression on you, especially in your early years?
Well, I was always very taken by Japanese cinema.
Okay.
And both the Japanese cinema that was more successful outside of Japan, the cinema of Kurosawa and Mitsoguchi, but in particular, and in fact more recently, more and more in fact, it is Ozu that speaks to me.
Okay.
In a very direct, very powerful way. But I still remember sitting in the cinema in Milan at age 14 and watching The Seven Samurai for the first time and being completely blown over, you know, admiring the ability to mix kinetic action and character, and fusing, in fact, the two, fusing the weather with the character, the action, yeah. And the stillness interspersed with the action. I actually watched The Seven Samurai recently with one of my daughters, and I was very happy to say that she also loved it. Always great to share something that you like, children, them approving whatever you like. It doesn't happen very often, but it did happen with The Seven Samurai.
You also strike me as quite a cinephile, and I think that's often a great way to sort of at least set the foundations for any kind of career you have in film. And I've heard you before talk in interviews how these masters of film like Ozu and Kurosawa, Ken Loach as well, probably because your last three films are very sort of British realist dramas in a way. They're teachers that we can learn from.
What I think happens is that the language of the great filmmakers seeps into your consciousness.
Yeah.
And when you then approach a subject that naturally has connections with some of that consciousness that you inherited from the masters, then that consciousness comes out.
Yeah.
And so if you are dealing with a naturalistic portrait of a social situation in Northern England, it is quite natural that, having watched all of Ken Loach, some of the imprint of Ken Loach on your soul and in your brain sort of surfaces. And the same with Ozu. In fact, in particular, in the last couple of films, for me, the reference, if anything, was more Ozu than Ken Loach, even if they were set in the UK or in Northern Ireland, the case of Nowhere Special. And I'm now working on a picture which might happen next year, and that is a picture that makes me think more naturally of Kurosawa than Ozu. And I will be watching Kurosawa again, not to imitate Kurosawa, you cannot imitate Kurosawa, but to absorb the essence, try to absorb some of the essence of the language and why things work with his pictures. And again, what I was saying before, I'm particularly interested in the interaction between the atmospheres, the locations, and the characters, and how they inform each other. And the mixture of very quiet moments and very kinetic, very violent moments. And that's something that I hope will stay within me. But then when you're actually on the set making a film, you don't specifically reference, unless, of course, and I do that sometimes, I put in a little shot that is my thank you or my homage to Ozu, for example. So in the last film, in Nowhere Special, there is a shot which specifically comes from an Ozu film. It's not a copy, it's an homage to an Ozu film. And the same happened in the film I did before, which was called Still Life, where I have an apple, a peeled apple, that comes from late springs of Ozu. It's like saying thank you from, you know, up there, wherever you are. And I love your work. And this is my little thank you.
And maybe we could then now explore sort of where your ideas come from, because the three films that you've written and directed have been sort of newspaper stories or news stories that you've come across. And I wondered, what sort of draws you to this aspect of finding a story within that, and how do you then turn it into a film? Because it's very easy to see a headline and think that would make a great film, but then you've obviously got to go through the whole process of fleshing out the story.
It is the result of a very limited imagination and the fact that when you start with a true event of some kind, it gives you a springboard to go forward. And the way that I have gone forward on all, the only three films I wrote and directed up to now is specifically that. I read a little story that gave me an idea or an interest in an aspect of life, of society, of culture. And that generated months and months and months of research on the subject, on the environment, on the story itself, if the story had enough potential in it. as opposed to a, you know, the situation. One can be just a world, or the other one is a specific story. In the case of the last film, Nowhere Special, there was a specific story. And so I researched the background to the situation of the story for 6 months, and then I started writing. So the process is, first of all, something makes me curious, usually about lives and worlds very, very different from my very privileged ones. And then from then on, I try to inform myself of that world, of that story, of kind of things that would motivate the psychology of the characters in the world that I'm portraying, and then you start writing.
When you're writing this, obviously you talk about coming from a completely different perspective. How do you sort of navigate that, stepping into someone else's shoes, someone else's life, to sort of give it that real authenticity? Because it's quite a sort of difficult line to tread, I would feel, at least, to know that you're doing the character and the story justice from not having the same experiences that they had, or not sharing the same experiences. Because of course you can do so much research, but you still sort of need that authentic element. And I wonder how you tend to get that from the films that you make, especially in somewhere like Nowhere Special.
Well, the authenticity is always a big question. Have you been authentic, and to what have you been authentic? I mean, in the case of Nowhere Special, I read a newspaper article about this young father and his relationship with his four-year-old boy and their search for a new family for the boy. And I couldn't talk to the father or the child. And so what I did is I did research into the adoption process in the UK, the laws. I talked to hundreds of people that are involved in adopting, trying to adopt, or in helping to adopt, in having adopted. I talk to people who help children going through difficult psychological circumstances. And then, of course, I am a father. And so all these bits of information then get filtered through what makes sense to me as a father, even if my social or economic circumstances are very different from the characters in the film. So I think if there is authenticity, it's the authenticity of the filter, of the voice of the filmmaker who interprets other people's stories and filters them through his own soul or her own soul and makes them authentic that way. They're not authentic in the way that they are the thoughts, specific thoughts of the person that has inspired the story, but they're authentic in the humanity of the person who is telling you this.
Yeah, of course. And just to give our listeners sort of some background about the film Nowhere Special, it is about a father and a son. It's about their relationship, I would say, more than anything else. And the father, who for reasons I won't disclose, but is searching for a new family for his son. But it's very focused, like I said, on the relationship, how you sort of manage that with the relationship, obviously, as well with the actor Daniel, who I believe he was 4 years old. How was it directing him as well and guiding him through that? Because the relationship that they had also felt very sort of real in a way, which is, again, very hard to do.
Yes, we were very, very fortunate. I started the research knowing that the two central characters were a father and a son. And what I think the film ended up being is really a love story. An exclusive relationship, a love story between a father and his young boy, because those were the characters, 35 and 4-year-old characters, in the original newspaper article. But of course, you write a script and you give dialogue to your characters in the script, your people in the script. I hate the idea that they're characters, real people. And the writer just writes what he or she imagines wants to happen on the screen. But then, of course, that script then gets passed to the director, who in this case is the same person. And the director looks at the script and says, yes, but how am I going to get a 4-year-old to perform like a professional actor? At some point, somebody told me that there's no point in you trying to make this film because you can't physically make the film because you can't have a 4-year-old act. It doesn't work. It doesn't happen. You know, he will do something completely different from what you are hoping. And I was quite fortunate. I met a wonderful Spanish director called Carla Simón in Berlin a few years ago. And she had made a wonderful film called September I think it's called September 93 or something like that. And there the main character was an 80-year-old girl who was going also through a quite a traumatic experience. And I talked to her and asked her, how did she get to work with an 80-year-old? How was that performance so perfect, so truthful, so real and affected? And she said, well, look, it's very difficult to work with children. And she suggested that I look at a French film by Doyon, Jacques Doyon, called Ponette, where the central character, in fact, was a four-year-old girl. And there was a making of, I found a making of Ponette from directed by a Canadian director who was present on the during the shoot. And as Carla Simone had suggested, what you do and what they did with Ponette and what she did on her film is basically have somebody next door to the camera giving instructions throughout to their young actor or actress, in the case of Ponette. And then hopefully the child will say the right words or words similar to the ones that you would like them. And then you take those 10 seconds and you clean the sound from the voice of the director or the script person or even the parent of the child who was giving instructions to the child. And then you put it all together in the editing, you create, you know, with the other shots, and you create the scene, you create the relationship. And I thought that's what we would have to do. And I talked to Marius Panduru, my director of photography, our director of photography, and we said, well, let's shoot everything on the shoulder, handheld, so we can catch young Daniel, whatever he does, wherever he goes, and then hopefully he will do something that is similar enough to our story that we will then maybe shoot something different than we expect on the parents or on the grown-ups and create a different story but similar in tone. But for some like extraordinary reason, the gods of cinema, maybe Ozu decided to send us a message from up there, Daniel became a complete professional. And he had, from the very beginning, a very clear distinction between himself, meaning Daniel the boy, and Michael, the character or the person in the film. Very clear, there were two different people. My name is Daniel, he would say, and I am playing a boy called Michael. And he's a boy full of energy, full of charm, full of spirit, completely different, in fact, from the child I had written in the script. Okay. The Michael in the script was a quiet, introspective, observant a boy, that Daniel is very much a ball of energy.
Yeah.
And when we were filming, he would be jumping around the set and chatting to everybody, in particular with James, and we'll talk soon about James. But then when I would say, okay, now no more playing, now we work, I would tell James, I would tell Daniel, now we film, and James would become the character, would become the person that I had written, the father, John. And Daniel would take his lead from James and become Michael and literally say every word that was written for him in the script in the moment as I had imagined.
Right.
And of course, we did a lot of takes, but nonetheless, one of the things that really satisfies me about the film and on which I had very little control, so I'm not giving myself any credit for it, is that the relationship, as you were saying before, is very real.
Yeah.
Because the friendship between James and Daniel was very real. And the important scenes in the film, the relationship scenes between the two, are not constructed in the editing after the shoot, but they are happening in front of you. The two people are on the screen at the same time, very much at the same time, living in that moment and being those people in that moment. None of this could have happened if it hadn't been for James's dedication before the shoot and during the shoot of developing a real relationship with young Daniel, so that that friendship and that connection, that affection that you see on the screen is real, is actually real. It happened also off screen.
I also wondered what pushed you to sort of start writing and directing more, because this is your third film as writer-director. You've been working in the industry for almost 40 years. And you're, of course, perhaps really well known for being the producer of The Full Monty. And you, I believe, conceived of the idea originally and then brought other people involved to write and then direct it. But I wondered what's different then to now of wanting to write it and develop the story yourself and tell it, as opposed to back then with the full Monty?
Well, it sort of happened a little bit by chance. Many years ago, now 15 years ago or more, in fact, I was in Australia trying to get a big film made with some big Hollywood stars and established directors. And I literally spent 7 months there, most of those months away from my growing daughters. It was very difficult, painful. And at the end of those 7 months, the whole thing collapsed because of personality issues. It doesn't matter why it collapsed, but it collapsed. And the very same day that I had to let go, a very unhappy Australian crew that was prepared to, you know, make work for the next 3 months on this big film, I read of these 23 Sri Lankan handball players who had disappeared during a German handball tournament. And I felt the similarities with the story of the Full Monty, in the sense that there was opportunity of telling a story which with an engine which was a comedy engine, but that dealt with very serious subjects, like poverty in developing world, or the majority world, as it's called, and the desire to leave your own country, to go somewhere else and make your life a different life, in the same way that the Full Monty had been about unemployment and the difficulty for men to adjust to a new role in society. So the engine was a comedy engine, but the subject could have been serious. And the reason I said, I know how to make this, is because I knew how the Full Monty had been made.
Yeah.
And I also knew that because it was a film that was going to be shot in Sri Lanka, in Sinhala, because I wanted it, very few people would have seen it outside, most likely very few people would have seen it outside of Sri Lanka. And more than anything else, I could do it. I could be the director. I could be the writer or the co-writer. I could be the producer. And nobody would have left the film like the Australian film that I was trying to make, where the actor decided not to do it, or the director decided not to do it, and everything collapsed because other people decided that they had lost interest in the project. Well, the little Sri Lankan film I was going to make was going to happen because I was not going to quit as a writer, as a producer, and as a director. And that's really why I started directing. And I had such a great time making Machan in Sri Lanka. I spent a year there making this film. I had such a great time. I was very, very lucky. I had the most wonderful co-writer, Ruanti De Chiquera, to write the film with me. I had a great producer who is actually a director in Sri Lanka, Prasanna Vitarage, wonderful director, to help me produce the film. So I just had a wonderful time. And I had such a wonderful time directing that first film that I said, well, maybe one day if I find a story, a situation that attracts me again, I could try and do it again. And that's what happened with my second film. And it's now happening a bit more often.
You've got the itch and you can't stop.
I got the itch. It is really fun. I mean, if you spend 20 years producing and then all of a sudden you direct something different.
I can imagine.
It's a very different job, but it can be very satisfying.
Perhaps then my final question to you, and I don't know if it's too big to ask, would be, how has your relationship to film and cinema developed and changed over the years, especially as you take on a more directing role?
I think that I have become much more a critical, maybe. And a film to satisfy me has to give me a lot more than maybe in those, you know, 50 years ago when I was discovering the language of cinema and the history of cinema for the first time. And these days in particular, I think I tend to watch old films, classics, more than new cinema, which is a mistake, by the way, because cinema as a storytelling form, not an art form, a storytelling form, is continually evolving, and new voices tell you new ways of telling stories, but I should be doing much more of it.
Thank you, Roberto, for talking with us. It's been really great.
Thank you, Elliot.
For those that are perhaps interested by what we've been discussing, you can go see Nowhere Special from the 23rd of June onwards here in the Netherlands. Thank you very much for listening, and until next time.
Thank you.